Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Oh, I want to thank you all so much for allowing me to be a part of this weekend. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has given me a life I never would have wanted, and it's made me a person that I wouldn't have even liked when I came here. I really want to thank you guys for letting me be a part of this. This is definitely one of the most beautiful cities I've ever had the pleasure of getting a chance to spend some time. And Celeste and Terry and a number of you others have shown a lot of Southern hospitality. And I really want to thank you for showing me around and all of that. You know, I was thinking tonight when we were doing the songs and we were doing the countdown, and then last night, you know, I'm sure some of you saw Family Feud and then lots of the meetings. My favorite line in the Big Book right now, and it will change if you ever hear me again because it changes all the time, but right now one of my favorite lines is that we find that cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. And I saw a lot of that this weekend. And that has meant a lot to me over the years. I didn't have a sense of humor when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't laughed in a long, long time. And I didn't laugh that much after I got here. I didn't really think a lot was very funny. And I consider it a great gift that I've been given a sense of humor around here. Whenever I'm asked to talk in this capacity, I always try and remember to start off by saying the most important things that I say, no matter how long I stand up here and talk. And I'm telling you that because even today, when I go to a meeting, I don't always listen to everything the speaker has to say. I often have to get back to thinking about me. So if you happen to be sitting here, and especially if you happen to be new or visiting, if I could ask you to just hang in with me for a minute or two, I'm going to tell you the most important things I'll say, and then you don't really have to pay attention to much else. So the most important thing that I would want you to know tonight is that I am not an expert on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, or on anything else. I'm just a member, and I'm going to stand up here for a little while and share my experience, strength, and hope. The second thing that is really important to me that you know. Today, you know, I think, you know, a number of people, we were talking about it over the weekend, people come to Alcoholics Anonymous today in a lot of different ways. Back when I first got sober, the majority of people that came to Alcoholics Anonymous came in through a traditional 12-step call to our local central offices. Sometimes they were brought by a family member. Certainly there were people referred by a doctor, a minister, a rabbi, a judge, and there were very, very few hospitals or treatment programs. But today I find, as I go to meetings and meet new people, that the majority of people that I'm meeting are coming in through some type of a program. And I don't think it matters how anybody gets to Alcoholics Anonymous. But this is the thing that I want to say that is so important. Because people come in so many different ways, they often are confused about what part is Alcoholics Anonymous and what part is this facility that is helping them get to some meetings or, you know, whichever it might be. So what I want you to know, particularly if you're new or visiting, is that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. If it had not been free, I could not have come here. If it had not stayed free, I could not have stayed. I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket. And I have not been able to put a dollar in all the time since I was 10 years sober. This is not about money. And it's really important to me, if you're new or visiting, that you know that. You know, Francine mentioned the other night, she said, you know, something about, you know, how sometimes people come up and they thank you for saying something that really made a difference and that really helped them. And I've had the privilege of having that happen. But you never know how you're going to say something and it's going to mean something to somebody. I remember a woman came up to me a few years back now and she said, "I remember hearing you when I was new." And I said, "Oh, really?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "You said that you were over 10 years sober before you could afford to put a dollar in the basket." And she said, and I thought, what a loser. So you don't know what's going to stick with somebody. My favorite thing anybody ever said to me was a guy came up to me at a meeting to thank me for my talk, I think mainly because his sponsor was standing behind him and told him to. And he shook my hand and he said, "Thank you for your talk." He said, "I don't really believe that was your story, but I like the way you told it." And that's my favorite thing for a lot of reasons, primarily because what a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous that someone could doubt I came from where I came from and that I act and looked the way that I did when I got here. Because I do want to assure you that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked exactly like my story. And I looked like my story for a hell of a long time after I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I feel so grateful to have been born in a time when Alcoholics Anonymous exists. One of the greatest things I think about conventions of Alcoholics Anonymous is that hopefully you get a chance to see that we are people who normally would not mix. We're all different, but there's a lot of similarities. You know, there's a lot of things that Francine and I shared, you know, in our life, and there are things that Sheldon and I and different people that shared, you know, this weekend. And then there are things that are very different. You know, Sheldon last night shared about the fact that his parents were not alcoholic. You know, my grandfather was the drunk driver who was killed along with other people in his car and with people in another car when he was 46 years old over in Ireland. That left my grandmother a widow with 13 children. When my grandfather died at 46 years old, Alcoholics Anonymous didn't exist. When my father was born, who was going to drink himself to death alone in a hotel room, when my father was born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist yet. And he died alone in a hotel room drinking. My mother, when she was born, Alcoholics Anonymous was not even 1 year old. And my mother was going to be a person who was going to be in and out of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 40 years with varying periods of sobriety. Tonight, my mother has continually been sober for, I think it's 13 years now. So it does seem in my background that it might have a genetic possibility, you know, effect. I think, too, about there's so many wonderful things, you know, that we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous if we have the privilege of having someone that'll teach us about the traditions and about the history. And I could tell from meeting a lot of you that you guys have that going on here. And I'm so happy for you guys that you do. You know, I was talking to your delegate, Rick, today, and I was telling him that someone had told me a couple years ago they were sitting at coffee after a meeting. And one of the people at the table said, "Hey, who's this Bill Wilson guy that I hear you guys talk a lot about?" And it made me realize that Alcoholics Anonymous, I would say, using a historical measure of 25 years, that people getting sober now are in the fourth generation of Alcoholics Anonymous existing. I believe that I had the privilege of getting sober in the second generation. And because of that, I had the great privilege of knowing many people that were from the first generation members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, Bill Wilson, by the way, in case you're new, was one of the people that we consider to be a co-founder in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when Bill Wilson, I'm not going to tell you the whole history of AA, so don't panic. But we consider the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous to have been when Bill Wilson talked with Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob got sober. Now, Bill Wilson, at the time that he began to talk to Dr. Bob, and we had two people, one alcoholic talking to another, Bill Wilson had 6 months sober. There isn't an alcoholic in this room that does not know how long 6 months sober is. It was a big deal. It's still a big deal. But they didn't really know why or how Bill Wilson was staying sober 6 months. And Bill had a very nervous stomach. He had a lot of ulcers. He had a lot of complaints. And because of this nervous stomach, he used to drink sauerkraut and tomato juice because that would calm his stomach. Now, like I said, they really didn't know exactly what Bill Wilson was doing right to have 6 months. So back then, when newcomers came to AA, they gave him some tomato juice and sauerkraut, just in case. They wanted to be safe here. And so aren't we lucky to have been born in a time when the book is... We got a book, we've got steps, we've got traditions, you know. And we know that there is a solution. So I'm a person who believes I was born an alcoholic, and I don't want to have a philosophical discussion about that with anybody after the meeting. But I believe that, you know, for a lot of different reasons. But whether or not it's true, I know for sure that there was something wrong with me before I ever even started to drink. Now, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I grew up with a lot of violence. I grew up with a lot of abuse. I grew up with a lot of broken promises. And I grew up with a lot of things that happen in some alcoholic homes. They don't happen in all of them, but they happened in mine. And my first obsession was not with alcohol. My first obsession began, as far as my memory takes me back, to when I was 5 years old, and that obsession was with suicide. And I began to try to kill myself from the time that I was 5 years old, because life always hurt way too much for me, and I did not see anything good coming. You know, I was seeing my mom get beat up on a regular basis. You know, there was a lot of, you know, just different kinds of things going on, and I just didn't see it getting any better looking around the world. And so I was ready to get out. And obviously I'm still here, so I didn't get out. But at the age of 5 years old, I began to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades. I began to beat myself with a hammer. I began to burn my body. And, you know, what I have come to believe, doesn't mean I'm right, is that as I look back on my life, I was to find that I would much rather you punch me in the face or break something on my body than hurt my feelings. I was very, very sensitive, and I hated that about myself. And it was something that I was, that self-hatred that I felt about being weak and not able to control my emotions was a huge old idea that took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to work through and to begin to look at differently. So when I was a little kid, I was an only child. I grew up, my mom was a single mom, and my mom drank in very rough bars in Venice Beach. It's a town in Los Angeles. And I saw men and women handling life very differently. To my memory, I do not ever remember seeing a man shed a tear under any circumstances. And in my life, I have seen men shot, I've seen them stabbed, I've seen them arrested, I saw their kids overdose, I saw their wives leave them. I do not ever remember seeing a man cry. And the women in my life, some of them were very tough. They all, however, had a breaking point, and I saw them cry under one or more of those different circumstances. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And when I was a little kid, they'd say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I said, "A boy." Now, they probably thought it was funny the first couple of times, but I stayed with this answer, and they became very concerned. And I was raised Catholic, and my mother took me to the priest, and I'm sure the priest was probably also concerned about the fact that I was cutting my wrists and doing these other things. And he suggested that because we were on welfare, my mother could begin to take me to different professionals. And I did see some professionals, not as many as lots of other people in Alcoholics Anonymous have seen. But I saw some. And I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about what some of these very well-meaning professionals probably would have liked to say or do to help me. Because I felt about those people much like a woman I got sober with named Hattie Hicks did. I thought those people should have to work for their money. And I never told them anything. I never answered any questions. I never filled out their forms. And I would not play with their dolls. So I wasn't able to get any help from that. And as I was growing up, my first lesson that I can kind of look back and see in acceptance was to realize I was not going to be able to be a boy. And if I couldn't be a boy, the way I saw the world, which does not mean the way the world was, the way I saw the world, the only option that I could choose was to try and be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of time after I got here trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. And to me, that was to try and be as much like a man as I possibly could, especially in the sense of emotion. And that meant that I had to be in a gang, and I was. Meant that I had to do a lot of fighting, and I did. It means I always like to remember, however, to mention I've never won a fight in my life. But I never fought less than five people at a time. And my sponsor explained to me after I'd been sober for a while that, you know, if you fight one person and you lose, people can question about whether you're tough or not. But if you always fight five or more, no one is expecting you to win. So that's just kind of the way I did things. You know, I started to use drugs on a regular basis when I was 7 years old, and by the time I was eight, I was drinking on a regular basis. By the time I was nine, I found a combination with alcohol that I never altered in any way because it got me exactly where I wanted to go. And kind of like Francine was saying, I'm not a party girl. I have never had a social drink in my life. I have never said no thank you. I've had enough. I do not believe I've ever drank without getting drunk. That was the point. And I wasn't drinking to feel good. And believe me, if you're new, there are a lot of party animals in Alcoholics Anonymous that can tell you some wonderful, funny, great times before they cross that invisible line. But that is not my story. I wasn't drinking to feel good. I was drinking to not feel anything at all because everything I felt hurt. And the only emotion that I wanted to allow myself to experience was anger and rage. So, as I mentioned, my mother was a person that was going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was going to continue for quite a while. I would stand down there on the boardwalk in Venice. You know, and if you're a tough broad from a beach town anyway, or at least my beach town, you got to have tough feet. So you had to be able to walk down an alley with broken glass and not cut your feet. And I would see sometimes kind of touristy-looking people looking at me and my gang, and I would take my cigarette and I would throw it down on the sidewalk and I would put it out with my bare feet. And then sometimes I'd see them whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying to one another. They're going, wow, that is a tough broad. And I was very impressed that I could do these things, and I assumed they would be very impressed also. Again, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that, you know, maybe they were saying to one another, did you see that? I mean, that person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid? But I didn't know there was another way of looking at it. My mother brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because I wanted to go, but because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment by throwing a party or something. So I came into that meeting that night. I didn't raise my hand. I wasn't an alcoholic. And even if I had been, I wasn't going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. I had blamed my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life, and a lot had gone wrong. But that night in that meeting, there was a guy there that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And again, you may not identify in any way with what it was that brought me back to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But this guy, Paul, he was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. He was one of the most hostile and violent people that I knew. Paul won fights. My mother lost every fight because she only fought men. But Paul had won some of those fights, and he was at that meeting that night. And I couldn't even imagine why someone like that would go to AA if you could win fights. I mean, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But that's what I wanted. And so I talked to Paul after the meeting, and Paul had a motorcycle, and he'd just gotten out of jail, and he had a knife on his belt. And I talked to him after the meeting, and then I got drunk the next night because I was an alcoholic. And then I came back to some meetings, and I didn't raise my hand, but I talked to Paul. and only Paul. And I explained to Paul that I was not an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who we all knew was an alcoholic, and that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do, that I had my whole life ahead of me, and I was not an alcoholic. And of course, I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people they're not alcoholic, because they know that, you know. And Paul turned to me and he said, "You know, June, I'm new in this AA thing, and they've told me that I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own." He said, "But in your case, I'm going to make an exception." He said, "I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals, and I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be selling stuff, you're going to be selling your ass, you're going to be shooting stuff." You know, and I knew it wasn't like a high school teacher that was making something up to scare the kids. He was talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened or were beginning to happen in my life, and I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I felt more anger and more rage and more hatred toward than my mother was me. I hated everything about myself, and most of all, I hated the fact that I was weak. I hated having curly hair. I hated being from Venice. I hated being tall. I hated being skinny. I'd gone to 18 grammar schools, 7 junior highs, 5 high schools. I didn't like being the new kid. I didn't like anything, you know, about you or me. And I came, you know, to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in this 2-week period of time, every option but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. As I mentioned, you know, when I was filled with that kind of anger and I blamed my mom for so many things that had gone wrong, we used to have a physical relationship. And she was getting sober again, and she didn't think she had to be subjected to any kind of physical attacks in her apartment. And she asked me to leave, and I did. And I didn't have any kind of relationship with my family, the rest of them, aunts and uncles and stuff, until I was 5 years sober before I was invited back home for any kind of events. And I'd been in a number of foster homes. None of them would take me back. And then there were a couple of alcohol recovery homes in the area at that time, just, I think, at least three that I knew about. And I contacted three, and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who cares? Who cares about these programs? Who cares about these family stuff and these foster homes? Because none of that really matters. If you're a tough broad from Venice Beach, the only thing that really counts is your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all 5 members of my own gang beat me up. And I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had no money, and I had no place to live, and I didn't wear shoes. And I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know tonight that there were some people in that meeting that did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I know that is because after I raised my hand, after that meeting, some of the people at that meeting knew how old I was because my mother had been in and out of that group for so many years. And they came over to me after the meeting, and they told me that they didn't want a little kid to sit in their meetings when they talked about serious things. And they told me that if I came back, they would get together and throw me out. And I just thought AA didn't want me either. And that was okay with me because I didn't want me either. And I had not for as long as I could remember. And I didn't know, of course, that Alcoholics Anonymous had a third tradition that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I'm quite sure that those members did not know that either that day. Anyway, I went over to a friend of my mother's house, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited, and I went into the bathroom to see what kind of pills they had, and I took enough of them to kill myself one more time. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got there, I could not stand and I could not sit. I had to lay in the meeting. And normally where I got sober, they do not call on people to share who are laying in the meeting. But they did call on me that day. They realized I needed to be in a hospital, and that was where I came to next, with the doctor giving me medicine to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken in order to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably could not have brought me out of. And I cannot tell you exactly why that overdose was any different than all the many overdoses I'd inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. You know, when I got out of that hospital, which was just hours, I wasn't there for days, I was just there hours. When I got out of that hospital, I became very, very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the years that I have been sober, and in a variety of different ways, which is one of the wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. In those early years, I went to 21 meetings a week for most of my first 2.5 years sober. And I'm so, so grateful to the old-timers who were here when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and who tolerated me the way that I was. And tolerate is really the best word I can think of to try and explain the way that I was. You know, I getting sober did not feel good. All those feelings of hatred that I'd had for myself were right here waiting. And I was just miserable and filled with self-pity. And I went to these 21 meetings a week. I had a commitment at every one of those meetings. Most of them I got to early, and most of them I was the last person to leave. Because I had absolutely no place else to go that was indoors. I wasn't trying to get a gold star in AA. I just had nothing else to do and no place else to go and no one that wanted to be around me. And I didn't want to be around me either, you know, but I just went to lots and lots of these meetings. And, you know, I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had smoked since I was 7 or 8 years old, so I still smoked when I got here back then. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you could smoke in the meeting, and so of course I did, and I started smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Now, sometimes someone would offer to hold a match, and I let them hold a match as long as they liked, but I lit my own cigarettes. Nobody lit my cigarettes. And sometimes I'd be walking toward a door, and someone would hold a door, and I let them hold it as long as they liked, and when they got tired and they closed the door, I opened it for myself only. I did not ask for rides most of the time. I didn't accept rides a lot of the time. I walked to meetings, took a bus if I had enough money, and I hitchhiked. And it really is very funny because somehow, if I was hitchhiking and someone in AA picked me up, that was okay. I can't quite understand it myself, but it was okay to get a ride if I was hitchhiking, but I wouldn't accept a ride that was just offered. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was as much kindness and love in all of the things that we offer to people who come in that are new. And I was completely incapable and unwilling to accept any of it. And I think that because of that, it's one of the reasons that speaker meetings have always been super, super important to me. And they still are. And it's one of the reasons that I show up when I come here and I travel across the country. It would be very nice if I say something that helps somebody tonight. And of course, I hope that that could be true, that I could share something that you could relate to and that might help you stay sober or go to one more meeting or whatever it might be. That'd be great. But the truth is that I owe a debt to Alcoholics Anonymous that I will never be able to repay. And I owe that debt to thousands and thousands of members of Alcoholics Anonymous who showed up and spoke at meetings when they could have stayed home and watched a football game, when they could have stayed for their kid's birthday party, when they could have slept in, when they could have done whatever they had going, because they had lives going. And I didn't, you know. And a lot of those people, I don't know their names. You know, I don't remember anything that they said. I mean, like if they had a Doberman that drank vodka, I'd remember that. That's just kind of the way my head works. You know, it'd be great if instead I had a, you know, photographic memory for every page in the big book. But no, I remember like Dobermans that drank vodka. So, but you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want you to touch me. I didn't like women. I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't want to sit next to women. I didn't want to hug women, and I did not like to listening to women speakers, which always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. And the men that I had known in my life, if alcohol got involved, there was a lot of violence, and the women always lost. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous were identifying themselves as alcoholics, and I didn't want anything to do with them either. And I had a problem, because when I came here, all we had were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. And so here I was smoking my 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and after a little while, I didn't think that was enough to keep people away, so I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. I had a chain that I wore on my wrist and one on my ankle. I had a jacket, and on the back it said, "Do unto others and then split," which was my own spiritual philosophy. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I still had a black eye and a swollen lip from the last time when my gang had beat me up. And, you know, we get these commitments, and, you know, I love the way we just give out commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. So at the Tuesday night 2+2 meeting, my commitment was the greeter. So I stood there barefoot, my motorcycle jacket, chain, cigar, black eye, welcoming the new people if they came to AA. Sometime as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor say, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." And when I was standing at that door, those people who did not know how old I was, they were guessing my age at about 37. And as I stood at that door that night, I was actually 13 years old. I have now been continuously sober since July the 13th, 1972, when I was 13 years old. And you're 1972, right? I saw you and I were sitting down at the same time. Yeah. And, you know, what's fascinating about that is even if you're as bad at math as I am, you got to figure, okay, so that means she's 47 years sober. Now, if she's 47 years sober and then she was 13 when she got sober, then she's got to be even older than the 37 that they were guessing her at, which is absolutely true. But here's what's amazing to me. I'm standing here tonight, 47 years later, and I feel 1,000 years younger than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you either know what that feels like or you don't. But I will tell you, when I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we had some very persuasive, wonderful old-timers here. And there was not one of them or all of them put together that could convince me that someday, if I practiced these principles and I began to have a spiritual awakening and a psychic change, that someday I was not going to feel old like that. How could that happen? How could that make any sense? How do you make somebody not be old once it's already happened? You know, I didn't believe it. But when I mentioned, you know, how I come out here or I show up when I'm asked to talk, those people that spoke particularly from podiums because I couldn't let anybody get near me, that is where I heard the language of the heart in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believed those people. You know, I believed that they had come in here from a place like myself of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and somehow they had done these things that were asked of them, and somehow at some point they were able to walk out there on the sunny side of the street. They were able to look somebody else in the eye, and they were able to even look themselves in the eye. And I didn't believe that could happen for me. I honestly thought, you know, maybe one day, when I'm walking down the street and I happen to glance in one of those storefront windows which is the closest thing to ever looking in a mirror I was ever planning on doing. Maybe I wouldn't feel like throwing up at what was looking back. And that was enough hope to keep me coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you a couple of different, you know, stories tonight. There were a couple things that I wanted to, you know, that I really would like to try and share with you. One of them, well, so I have a seventh grade education. I dropped out of school in seventh grade. When I got sober, my first sponsor really wanted me to go back to high school, and I did try, or I don't know if I really tried. I went, but I didn't fit in very well. They didn't want me to smoke. They wanted me to wear shoes. You know, when I got to the program, my whole vocabulary consisted of profanity with a few exceptions, the and mother, you know. So I wasn't really suitable high school, you know, material. And I felt 1,000 years old, you know, so I really could not relate in any way to being in high school. So my sponsor, who was very practical, said, all right, if you're not willing to get an education, then you'll get the kind of jobs that people with seventh grade educations can get. And that is what I did. And I got a lot of those jobs, and I was a terrible employee, by the way. But I would, you know, sometimes show up. Sometimes I'd try out those, like, AA slogan things. So I'd stay out after the meeting, and I'd go out to coffee with whoever was staying out the latest. And then I'd hitchhike home. Well, I didn't really have a home, but I'd hitchhike and stay, either walk in the beach or I'd stay on someone's couch if they were letting me. And then before I'd go to sleep, I'd say, okay, God, I have to be at work tomorrow on that new job at 8 a.m. So if it's your will for me to work there, make sure I'm awake. And it really didn't seem like it was God's will for me to work anywhere, because I just could not get up in the morning. And so I got fired a lot. Anyway, eventually my sponsor convinced me to go to this kind of a program to learn how to get some practical skills. And so I went ahead and I signed up, and because she made me. And I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. And I typed one day at a time for months. And at the end of that time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And they told me, you are not going to make it as a secretary. And I thought, I could have told them that, you know, before I even started. But they said, you might be able to get some other kind of office job. You know, you're pretty good with those letters. You know, maybe you can get a filing job. And so I went, and some women on the program took me, and they dressed me, and they gave me some clothes, and they took me to Salvation Army, and they bought me some other stuff, and we put this stuff on. It was kind of like, look at the little Venice Bride in the citizen costume. And I went out there, and I went on these job interviews. It was just horrible, but I got a job. It was a very square job. I thought, the kind of thing your sponsors love. And I worked, and on the seventh day, they called me in. I thought they might be giving me a raise. And they said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. You don't have enough experience for this job. And they said, and not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. And I didn't really know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I went downstairs, and I called our Los Angeles Central office, and I reported that company. I figured we would pick it. You know, I didn't think we were going to let people fire us sober. I was 2 years sober, but they didn't want to pick it. And now I had to go look for another job, and I put on these citizen-y type clothes, and this woman in the program took me downtown. And I'd never been downtown, and she took me to a bank. I'd never been in a bank. And she took me over there, and I went on a series of interviews with this bank, and not only did I get hired to work in the bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know, because I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking, you know, and I wasn't sure that you really needed to give that up to be sober. It was kind of an unrelated activity, you know. So, anyway, I wanted to get a driver's license. And in California, you cannot get a driver's license unless you go to high school and take this class about training you, or you take this class somewhere else to train you. And so I found out that I could take that class at a city college. And back then in California, for like $7, if you signed up, you could take 10 classes or one class, it was like $7. And I had $7. And I went down and I signed up for that driving class. And while I was there, I heard people in the lobby and they were talking about a dummy English class. And you know, I was 2.5 years sober at that time. And if you had asked me to read chapter 5 or the traditions or anything else, I could read it and you'd hear every word and I could pronounce it correctly. But I could not remember a whole sentence that I had read right after I'd read it. And I was really sure that I had done permanent damage to my brain. And I thought maybe this dummy English class could help me a little bit. So I signed up for that class too. And I took those two classes. And then the next semester I took some more classes. And I got a bunch. I got laid off. And I got a bunch of different part-time jobs. And I found a garage that I could live in Culver City for $40 a month. And eventually I got a car that I was able to. I was able to buy my secretary and my home group, you know, co-signed on that loan where I paid $33 a month for 10 months so that I could get a car. And anyway, I started, you know, just showing up and doing more classes and keeping my AA commitments. I was very active in general service and continued to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to lots and lots of classes, and after a couple of years, they called me in, and they told me that I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. So I thought that was a good name for a college degree. I had never really planned on getting a college degree. No one in my family had ever gotten one, and while I was there, my sponsor had made me take that GED, so I'd have that equivalent to a high school diploma. And then I'd come up with a dream, and I don't know when I had the dream, but my sponsor said, when you have a dream, you have to do the same footwork anybody in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous has to do to make a dream come true. So I did that footwork, and I got accepted to a university, and I continued going to school. And at the end of that time, I had to do more footwork in order to make that dream come true, and I did more footwork, and now it's been over 35 years ago, but I received a telegram telling me that I had been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but not on that side of the table. And I will tell you that I have the privilege of having a job where I truly believe I'm able to be of service. And I have a job where I have not ever one day gone to work where I am not reminded of the places that alcoholism takes people like me. It does not take everybody to the same places, but I know the places it takes people like me. So the first good thought I ever had about myself that I remember in my whole life was I was about a year sober. I was super active in my home group, which was amazing. It was a great home group. And somehow that night I had this thought. I thought, I'm a good member of this group. And I had never thought anything that I can remember ever positive about myself at all, you know. And I, like I said, I stayed really active. Now, when I was 7 years sober, I went to this convention. And it was the Palm Springs Roundup, so I know Francine's been out there, and maybe a few of you, maybe, I don't know. But it was a very fancy convention, actually. On Saturday night, people dressed up like they were going to the Academy Awards, you know. And I still didn't have, I didn't have any money. Someone had given me a banquet ticket. Someone had given me a dress to wear so that I could go that night. And as I sat there at my table, I looked around the room comparing myself to everyone else in the room, something I still do on days when I want to make myself feel bad. And I was looking around and I talked to myself, you know. So I was wearing this brown dress. And so I looked at my dress and then I looked at this black dress across the room and I go, wow, now that is a gorgeous dress, isn't it, that she's wearing? I go, yeah, it is. And I said, now don't you wish you were wearing the black dress? And I go, no. I go, what do you mean no? I go, no. I'm glad I'm wearing the brown dress. It's like, you are kidding. And then I started asking myself other questions. I didn't mind having curly hair. I didn't wish I had your mom. I didn't wish I wasn't from Venice. But here's the most incredible thing that happened, that had never happened in my whole life that I remember. Not before I was drinking, not while I was drinking, and not that I can recall in that first 7 years sober. All of a sudden, right then, I wanted to feel exactly like I felt. I could not believe it. I had just never experienced that. And like I said, there wasn't one or all of the old-timers put together that could have told me that someday I was going to feel like that. I would not have believed them ever. And it would make a much better AA talk if I could tell you that from the time I was 7 years sober, forevermore, up till now, it's always been like that. That would not be true, however, in my case, you know. But I will tell you this. It has been many, many, many years since I have seriously considered the idea of trading places with anybody. And I want to let you know that in my life, in sobriety, pretty much like everyone else that I have ever known that has stayed sober, I've had some pretty tough bumps. Maybe not as hard as some of the bumps that some of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have had. I know that for sure. And maybe a little harder than some of the other bumps that some people have had. But it doesn't really matter. They've been my bumps, you know. And I could actually pretty much tell you that there's a few things going on in my life today that I bet you wouldn't want to be having going on in yours. But the thing is that for me, who always looked at other people and wished I could be like them or where they were, or whatever, not have what was going on. It's a really big deal to me when I stand up here and I tell you, I'm not trading places with anybody. I will take all of my cards exactly as they are. Now, I'm going to tell you two stories, I think, and then I'm going to sit down. So one is when I was 30 days, a little less than 30 days sober, and I know it was because I was a little less than 30 days sober, because this woman came and talked at that 2+2 meeting where I was the greeter, and her name was Sybil. And Sybil was the first woman to get sober west of the Mississippi. And that night when she talked, if I'm correct, she had 32 years sober right then. Now I'm 13, so you can imagine if she's got 32 years sober, I mean, she's a lot older than me. Anyway, and so she was talking, and, you know, I don't really remember a lot of what she said, but then at the end, you know how they'd do this? The old timers would do this, you know, a lot of times they'd go, and newcomers? So then I thought, oh, this is my part. So I thought, yes. Now I'm going to listen. She said, and newcomers, she said, I have an amazing life. She said, I'm married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, and Bob and I have so much fun. And we have a life beyond our wildest dreams because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, and do you know, newcomers, if I could wave a magic wand and give you an amazing life, I wouldn't do it. I was like, wait a minute, did I hear that wrong? I mean, somebody should report her to the New York General Service Office. I mean, that's just mean. Isn't she supposed to say, I wish I could wave a magic wand? I mean, I'm from Venice. I know there aren't any magic wands. But she's supposed to say it that way. She said, I wouldn't do it. She said, I wouldn't do it because I wouldn't want to rob you of your journey. Well, as I sat there that night, I was 13 years old. I had a 7th grade education. I didn't have a dollar in my pocket. I didn't have any shoes. I didn't have any place to stay. I was facing court cases and deportation. And I just want to say very clearly that I really didn't want a journey. You know what I mean? It's like, just, I don't want a journey. Just wave the wand, you know. Of course, now I'm up here many, many years later, and I'm so grateful, you know, that she didn't wave a magic wand and rob me of my journey. But here's the thing that I want to make sure you know. Nobody can rob you of your journey except you, because it's your journey. And one of the great things in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that I have come to learn and see is that you don't have to drink to start over here. There will always be someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that could be willing, if you ask, to be your guide and to help you as you move forward. Now, I want to tell you just a little bit more about Sybil. So when Sybil got sober, she was married. And after she'd been sober for a couple of years, she was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after she'd been sober for a little while, she came home one night and her husband said, he said, I like it better when you're drinking. And he poured her a glass of wine. And so she left that marriage. Now, when Sybil came to that first meeting in Los Angeles, as I said, she was the first woman to come in. So back then in Los Angeles, people drove hundreds of miles, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 hours just to get to a meeting. And there was only one meeting a week. So it was all men. Sybil came to that meeting. She had written a letter to New York General Service Office. They told her where the meeting was. She was scared to go alone. And she brought her husband, who was not an alcoholic. And he was happy to take her. And he was like, let's make sure you get over there. So they went to this meeting. And when they first got in the hall, there were men and women. And then all of a sudden, this one man stood up and he goes, all right, all the women have to leave. We're starting the meeting. So all the women left. Well, most of the women were wives, and they were there trying to make sure their husband went to the meeting. But they made Sybil leave, and Sybil thought they made her leave because they were embarrassed and horrified by the kind of woman that she was. She took it very personally. Now, they went into the meeting, and back then, meetings were not like from 7 to 8 or 8 to 9. Meetings went as long as everybody needed them to go. And like I said, these guys had driven 2, 3, 4 hours. They were not in a hurry. You know, they weren't watching that, hey, it's 8 o'clock, you know, we got to end the meeting. Now, Sybil's husband, as I mentioned, had been kept inside because he was a man. And he explained to them that he was not an alcoholic. But they had heard that sort of thing before. So they kept him in there a few hours trying to explain to him about denial. And he finally was able to escape from the meeting. And they left. And Sybil was crying, and she dropped him off at home, and then she went to the bar. She got really drunk, and about 2 in the morning, she remembered that in this letter New York had written to her, there was a phone number. And so she called that number at 2 in the morning. She got Cliff Walker, one of our early AA members out in Los Angeles, and she said, I'll just have you know I went to your meeting tonight, and they threw me out. She said, and I'm going to report you to New York tomorrow and have you fired. And he said, Sybil, we've never had a woman. Please, come back. Come back next week to the meeting. Well, believe it or not, Sybil's husband would not go back with her. But Sybil's brother was a guy named Tex. And Sybil and Tex did a lot of drinking together. But Tex didn't like to drink with Sybil because she was little and she always started fights and he always had to finish them. So he kind of stopped drinking with her. But he was still a big drinker. And she said to him, she said, I'm going to go back to that AA meeting, Tex, this coming week. And Tex said, you know what? Because I got that farm, and I got all those guys that work for me picking fruit, and you know what? A lot of those guys are drinking too much. So I'm going to tell them they either go to AA or they're fired. So that next week, they loaded up all the guys in the back of the pickup truck that worked for Tex and Sybil and Tex, and they drove to the meeting. Now, there were more of them going into the meeting than were AA members at the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, they were given out like sacks, pillowcases, filled with letters that had been written to New York after the Jack Alexander article in 1941. We got thousands of letters. I mean, thousands was a lot. So they divided these letters up to San Diego, and they gave them to the guy who'd driven in from San Diego, and they had a bunch of letters from Fresno area, and they gave them to that guy, and they had a bunch of other letters from all over. And at the end, they had this one pillowcase left. And they said, now, Sybil, come on up here. And she was terrified. And they said, now, you guys, we got a woman alcoholic. This is Sybil. And they said, now, Sybil, these are all the letters from the women. We're going to put you in charge of all the women. She said, oh, don't do that. She said, I've never stayed sober a week. I won't even be back here, probably. He said, well, you know, we're going to give you a chance. We want you to do this. And she said, well, I don't know what to tell him. And he said, well, you don't know much, because you've only been to one meeting. So what you're going to do is you're going to knock on the door and you're going to say, did you write this letter? I wrote a letter just like this, and I've been down there one time. I don't really know what they're doing, but it seems like it might be working. And if you'd like to come back to the meeting with me, I'm going to go back next week. And Tex took Sybil and drove her on every one of those 12-step calls, and neither one of them ever drank again. When Sybil died, she had 57 years sober. And at the time that she died, that was the longest living sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that we ever had. Now, when I tell you that Sybil's husband, you know, gave her that ultimatum after a couple years sober and said, I want you to drink, she walked out and left that marriage. And not too long after that, Sybil and Tex went into a business, but the business failed. and they had to file bankruptcy. And then Tex, who was Sybil's best friend, got very, very sick, and he died from cancer. And at that time, Sybil was about 11 years sober, and she was having a really hard time. And she wrote a letter to Bill Wilson. And I don't have that letter, but I have the letter that Bill Wilson wrote her back. And I was thinking about it a lot today, and I was also noticing that it was written in October, where we are right now. And so I wanted to read you this letter. It's dated November 6, 1952. My dear Sybil, thanks for your letter of October 21st. It was just about the most stirring thing I have read in many a day. The real test of our way of life is how it works when the chips are down. Though I've sometimes seen AAs make rather a mess of living, I've never seen a sober one make a bad job of dying. But the account you give me of Texas' last days is something I shall treasure always. I hope I can do half as well when my own turn comes. I am one who believes that in my father's house there are many mansions. If that were not so, there couldn't be any justice. I can almost see Tex sitting on the front porch of one right now, talking in the sunlight with others of God's ladies and gentlemen who've gone on before. I certainly agree with you that little was left in Tex's grave. All he had was left behind in the hearts of the rest of us, and he carried just that same amount forward to where he is now. If you like what I've said, please read it to the Huntington Park group. In any case, congratulate them for me that they had the privilege of knowing a guy like Tex. And I know you guys here have lots of old-timers that are just like the Texes in your life, as I have had in mine. As for you, my dear, there's no need to give you advice. How well you understand that the demonstration is the thing after all. It isn't so much a question of whether we have a good time or a bad time. The only thing that will be asked is what we do with the experience we have. That you are doing well with your tough lot is something for which I and many others are bound to be grateful. This is but a long day in school. Some of the lessons are hard, and others are easy. I know you will keep on learning and passing what you learned. What more does one person need to know about another? Affectionately yours, Bill. So I want to read you one other thing. It's my very favorite thing. It's pretty short. And for me, it summarizes some of the most important things that I hope we all remember about Alcoholics Anonymous. I know most of you have heard it and probably heard it many, many times. But just in case there's a few of you that haven't, I thought I would take a moment and read this to you. This is the last talk by our co-founder, Dr. Bob. It's from when he appeared at our international convention. My good friends in AA and of AA, I feel I would be very remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to welcome you here to Cleveland, not only to this meeting, but those that have already transpired. I hope very much that the presence of so many people and the words you have heard will prove an inspiration to you. Not only to you, but may you be able to impart that inspiration to the boys and girls back home who were not fortunate enough to be able to come. In other words, we hope that your visit here has been both enjoyable and profitable. I got a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, with a feeling that possibly some small thing that I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I've been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like. So my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is. and we understand what service is. So let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue. And if we must use it, let us use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacence so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me to be part of your weekend.